Roll sound, Scotty.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
p.m. A crowded subway train starts its run from Pelham Station in the Bronx. 1:45 p.m. Four desperate, heavily armed men seize control of the train.
Open the door or I'll blow your head off.
Taking 17 people as hostages.
Your attention, please. Now then, you'll all remain seated. Anybody who tries to rise is going to get shot. I do hope I have made myself understood.
2:13 p.m. The city of New York is given 1 hour to come up with $1 million ransom.
You're out of your skull.
No unit stand by on a double.
What's up, Z?
A train's been hijacked.
Millions have read it. Now you can live it. The taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
There is no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
At precisely 3:13, we are going to begin executing the hostages.
Nothing will happen as long as you obey my orders.
New York City is held powerless in the grip of four ruthless men. From the mayor's office.
Don't tell me, I don't want to know.
To police headquarters.
I've got about 50 men inside the tunnel, all wearing vests and armed with machine and submachine guns. We could fight the Third World War down there.
To the nerve center of the world's busiest subway system.
My only priority is saving the lives of these passengers.
Maybe an hour isn't enough time.
An hour is plenty of time.
We agree to pay the ransom. Repeat, we agreed to pay you the money. Now turn your clock off. The money has to be counted, stacked, tied, transported uptown. It just isn't physically possible.
You'd be surprised what's physically possible.
Pelham 1-2-3's in motion.
There's no driving a train!
How long does it take to get all that money together anyway?
Just not gonna make it.
We'll never make it. The passengers are dead ducks.
What the hell do they expect for that lousy 35 cents to live forever?
Walter Matthau, Robert Shaw. The most spectacular hijack in history. The taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
It's the Stinking Paws podcast, celebrating 10 years of reviewing movies. Some good, some not so good, hey chaps. Scott here. Hello, Paul.
Good evening.
We are joined by a special guest because it's our 10th anniversary, and it's Anthony from the Glass Onion on John Lennon podcast, amongst others. Hello, mate.
Hello. Nice to be doing this on Saturday evening. Get the beers. Yeah, get a beer going, even though it's in a mug. That is beer. That is beer, by the way.
It makes a change. We normally talk early on a Sunday morning doing Britannia, don't we? So yeah. It's nice to be sitting here chatting to you, mate. And it's a movie we've reviewed before. You and I met up not so long ago to take another look at Deliverance. And following that conversation, you said to me, Scott, I really want to review this one. And previous conversations, I know this is one of your favourite movies. So,
yeah.
Pelham 1-2-3, what year? 1974.
Yeah.
74, so the year before Jaws.
Mm.
It's also notable that, Paul, it was the first movie
that I brought to Stinking Paws.
10 years ago.
Brings a tear to the eye, doesn't it? 10 years. Have so you've actually notched up, sorry, you've notched up 10 years now, have you, just recently?
No, because Paul sort of disappeared for a while because it was Charlie and I. Paul was a guest.
I don't know so much disappeared. I wasn't invited.
Yeah, following his original review of Pelham 123, we decided we didn't want him back. Because we did a Halloween special. And what did you bring to the Halloween special?
Well, in fairness, I was going to bring American Werewolf in London because I don't do horror films. I don't care for them. And Charlie had already nicked that, I think. And so I brought to... What did I bring?
Oh, Darkness Falls.
Darkness Falls.
Right. If you've never seen it,
don't.
It's sort of like a Legend of the Tooth Fairy type thing, isn't it?
Yeah. there's a sort of on the DVD. There's another short film goes along, which makes the film so much better because it sort of does this little documentary of the Tooth Fairy used to be someone that came around. If you had a tooth out, it was the local baker. And they'd leave cakes for you.
I don't remember any of this.
But then there was a big fire in the bakery and this woman was disfigured. So she scared all the kids. So they wouldn't let her sort of go round and drop the cakes off. So it then turned into the Tooth Fairy sort of thing. So she'd sneak in and leave something under the pillow.
You remember so much more of this movie.
But yeah, the movie was based on that. And it was like, but only appeared in darkness, you couldn't see him in light, sort of thing. And I watched it sort of 10 years prior to this podcast, and I watched it with a girl I was seeing at the time who loved horror films, so it was just a sort of we'll watch this tonight, okay, whatever.
so your memories of the night are clouded because the movie wasn't
went along with it for obvious reasons and remembered it as being okay. And it really wasn't.
It really wasn't, was it?
And it got absolutely ripped to pieces by the other four people, I think we have.
Bearing in mind, right, listen to this. The other four movies that we had was the original Frankenstein from 1932, James Whale, or whatever it was. American Werewolf in London, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
Was there one other?
There was...
But, you know, we've got real... Oh, The Exorcist.
Exorcist, yeah.
Real classic horror movies. And Paul, Darkness Falls.
It's because I didn't know horror. So you took the one away from me that I had seen.
American Werewolf has really aged well, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I
haven't seen it for years. I love it.
Still see clips of that now. And it is just... even the makeup of the change into the werewolf. It's outstanding that is 80s.
But
had there been a comedy horror before then? Because I remember as a kid we used to watch that as a family. We used to go to Video 83, if you remember that show, on Sunday after church, and watch it as a family, and we got American Werewolf. Is that, has anyone made a horror film that's like a comedy?
Well, before
had that been done? I don't know.
Yeah, Young Frankenstein.
Oh, right. I hadn't seen
that. Many others. Was that before?
Yeah, 76 or whatever it was. Yeah, 70s Young Frankenstein. Yeah.
Well, like that shocking level of horror plus comedy.
That's
mix the gore with the comedy. I don't know if that was unique.
Because that had that great mix of it really made you jump. Like when the werewolf jumped out on the moors or whatever. And the guy
in the subway, to mention subways again. The guy on the London Underground, do you remember the business plan? That's terrifying.
Right, again.
If you've never listened to that episode.
If you've not listened to that episode, there was five of us on that night. Was there five on two?
Yeah, so we're reviewing five movies.
So it's a long day. A long day.
Yeah.
And drinking from the beginning to the end. And there were things we took away from that day that have gone down in sort of Stinking Paul's lore, legend.
I was very, very, very drunk by the end.
Paul, bless him, Paul's notes consisted of like trivia from IMDb. So every now and again, Paul would come up with like this great bit of like trivia that was, you know, relevant and all this. What was the one that you must have told us so many times?
And the question was, why did they use Tottenham Court Road tube station? And because it's the longest escalator on there.
Paul told us that fact once. He told it a dozen times because every now and again he'd go, "Do you know why they used Tottenham Court Road tube station?" Oh, we got no, Paul, tell us. You know. But then also there was something, we had some nibbles or something we were eating.
We had some...
popcorn?
No, it was some kind of weird cheap maize thing that you'd bought.
Yeah.
But it tasted like sugar puffs.
That was it. And every now and again, Paul go, you could hear him crunching away in the background. He go, these really taste like sugar puffs. Go back to that. It's an early 10-year ago episode.
No,
it was our first horror
it's
special.
It's about 3 hours long.
Yeah, probably longer than that. It's amazing. I'm going to go back and have a listen.
Hey, how am I supposed to see what you... Holy God, what do you want?
I'm taking your train.
You're taking my train?
Turn around. I got something to show you.
What's going on? What is
Shut up.
I won't tell you again. Open the door or I'll blow your head off.
But anyway, Pelham 1-2-3, yes, back to business. Pelham 1-2-3 was the first movie proper that you brought to the table.
It was. I was trying to bring something that wasn't, because my standard movie watch at the time was anything modern, bit of action, bit of comedy. It was nothing that had any decent acting in, nothing that was like old and sort of a classic.
But we had the rule, didn't we, on Stinking Paws? Yeah. Nothing in the last 20 years, wasn't it, I think, originally?
Yeah,
I think
start with, yeah.
Yeah.
So I brought this to the table because it's a film I remember seeing as like a 12, 13-year-old lad and just flicking over to it one evening, probably BBC Two about then.
Mm-hmm.
And just being sort of transfixed from the start because it was such an interesting story, and it was just so beautifully paced, and so many, each time you saw a scene, so many questions popped into your head of, oh, what are they after? How are they going to get away with this? How are they going to escape? And it was just, I just in general, I like puzzles of any kind, so that it was a puzzle of a film. I just think Walter Matthau was, I just love his acting style. it's so always like he's not really trying.
Yes,
he's just so natural at it. Yeah. And he's always got that, whatever role he's in, he's always got that little glimpse of humor.
Yeah,
just in his sarcasm, especially near the start with the Japanese visitors coming
yes,
down.
Yes, of course.
I understand every word he's saying.
Yeah,
it's brilliant.
Just superb. And he's got a great comedy timing, even in like this film that wasn't a comedy. And it just always stuck with me, like through the years of just being one of those films. If ever I saw it on, even if it was halfway through, I think, oh, I'm just going to watch little bit of that and end up watching the rest of the film.
Anthony, this falls right into the wheelhouse of Easy Rider, Raging Bull, doesn't it? Mid-70s, 74. Was it a movie drone?
No, so it wasn't. I just remember when I first saw it, though, because we often talk about this. When did you first see it? It was during the Olympics, and I've worked out, because I must have been about 13, it was the Seoul Olympics, you know, the one where Ben Johnson was caught, 88.
Yeah.
So I was 13. So that was when I first
saw it. We would have seen it before then, mate. Yeah. We would have seen it 5-6 years previously, I'm assuming. Sort of.
And I think it was ITV because it's not, I did check that BBC genome and it's not on there. I remember their adverts. I remember their adverts. So I think it was ITV.
Yeah.
And the thing about it was, I saw it in, obviously, we get the TV Times or the Radio Times as it was then.
Mm.
And I saw it was the combination of Robert Shaw, who is definitely one of my favourite actors, as you
know. We know that.
I don't feel like he ever had the career he should have had. And I've got a fantastic biography of him in my collection. Mm-hmm. And again, it was alcohol was the main problem. Him and a heist movie. You know, I love a heist movie as well. I thought, I'm going to love this film. And I loved it every bit as much as I thought I would. It's one of those very rare things in life that didn't disappoint, you know, where you get high expectations. And I just thought,
The stars aligned for you, mate. A heist movie, Robert Shaw in 1974.
Yes, exactly.
What could go wrong? Yeah.
Nothing did go wrong. That's the thing. That's the amazing thing. Well, the thing about it, like, because I, do you remember we did that heist film, Prize of Arms?
Yes. Yeah.
And Paul, you may not, if you haven't heard of this, I don't blame you. It's very, very little known. It's appeared on YouTube. You can actually watch it on YouTube. And I think the boys, Stephen and Scott, were surprised how good it was.
Yes. Yeah.
As I was when I first saw it. And I did a bit of acting years ago. And if you do like amateur acting, amateur dramatics, it's a bit like a heist film. bear with me. And when you do like really low budget theatre, loads of shit can go wrong. Like, so if there's a table, like an object could roll off the table, and then you've got to decide, do I pretend this is part of the plot, or do I, you know, you can't say to the audience, oh, sorry about that. And a heist is a bit like that. You've got to hope that everything goes right. So if you take these fellas robbing a subway train, they've got to hope that maybe the motorman doesn't carry a gun, or, you know, anything. Like, yeah. So many things can go wrong. That what I love about it is just that element of, you know, they've got their plan, and then they've got to hope that, you know, like I said, the stars align, and, you know, they get a motorman who's not a hero or whatever. You know? Yeah.
It could have been that the subway car was full of people that wanted to have a go at them, if they'd rushed them, and
exactly, like,
if that copper had acted quicker. Yeah.
I was going to say that touch of having a cop on the train was brilliant, you know, because that really worked. Because I know we're going forward, but he comes off the train at the same time they do, doesn't he? When they fool that dead man's feature thing, he rolls off the train as well. And then you've got the brilliant touch that he's got long hair, so at the end Walter Matthau goes, don't worry, miss, we'll get you an ambulance. But no, totally, while you were talking, I was thinking of like 10 things I love about this film. Walter Matthau's perfect, because the first time you see him, he's sleeping, isn't he? He's having a nap.
Yes.
So he's got that kind of lazy, but he's clever, isn't he? You know,
you
can see what's happening.
Sharp brain on him, yeah.
A couple of steps ahead, yeah.
His whole face is a character anyway, isn't it? Just look at Walter Matthau and that's
like
that.
A puppy dog, isn't it?
He's like a caricature of himself, isn't he?
I'm really going to leap forward to the very end. When he opens the door to Martin Balsam's room.
Yeah.
And I've just remembered this from our original review. We found some review that said it was like a face that was built around a dill pickle appears at the door or something. Like that. And it's almost like a spitting image puppet, isn't he? You said, a caricature of himself. But it is that sardonic, sort of slow, self-aware, and like you said about, you know, the Japanese like element where he's taking the piss out of them basically, and they've understood every single bloody word he said.
Said, do whatever you like, they don't understand.
They don't understand. Yeah. They're just bowing and scraping and all this.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. And that great line, he goes, I've worked out how you're going to escape. You're going to make every man, woman and child in New York close their eyes and count to 100.
Exactly.
Just stuff like that. It's the voice, it's the voice and the face, isn't it? Really?
He does that perfect New York accent, doesn't he, as well. You get that point. And it's the relationship between him and all the other sort of staff members in the control room and sort of the off-site control rooms and all of that. And we've got to talk about Jerry Stiller. I'm sure there was something you wanted to say about Jerry Stiller. It's just that feeling that he's been there so long. He knows absolutely everything about the ins and outs of the work in the New York subway. But then when you see some of the other guys, the controllers, that have been there 30, 40 years as well, they live, breathe, eat, shit and sleep that job. They know it without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
So when the actual heist itself happens, the robbers are up against probably the best team in the world, you know, that could probably foil them, because they know everything there is to know about the subway system.
Even to the point before they announce themselves, they've spotted that this car has stopped where it shouldn't, and then they spotted that it's separated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, why is one sitting there and one's going through?
But then I thought at that point, okay, that is totally unusual. In this day and age, that probably would have been alerted to the police immediately at that point. You know? But looking at the technology, you know, it's like,
oh, I love that primitive where they're
following the light bulbs.
I love the fact one of the guys early on, he was flicking the switches to almost say to turn the lights to green or red. And I'm like, wow, it's not even that automated. Yeah. It actually relies on human
interaction. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sits perfectly. 1974, it just sits. I mean, we may talk about the remake at some point, but.
Two remakes.
There was a TV.
I haven't seen the TV one. I've seen the other one. It's horrible.
But obviously, technology has progressed so much, it makes it a totally completely different movie if you're to remake it. But let's stick with this one for the moment, and we can go on to the 74, the Denzel Washington one if we need to later. Anthony, you are probably the most prepared guest we ever had on this show and Real Britannia. How many pages of notes have you got there for us this week, mate?
Only four.
Only four. You let me down. Okay.
That was cut down from the original 10. I made notes on my notes and, just gradually got whittled down. Right. Very disappointing.
Let me throw it over to you. Start off with what you want to talk about then. Okay. Where are we going?
I was just going to say this actually. I was telling you off mic, I've got a flick chart that I've spent years building up. I've got 1,532 films on it, and this is number 11.
It's number 11.
Is it the 11th best film I've ever seen? I'm not sure. I really love it, but again, I saw it 13 or whatever I said earlier.
Can I ask for a couple of the movies above it?
I can probably predict about.
Well, number one is Raging Bull. That is my favourite.
Okay.
Partly because I'm fascinated by boxing. Just some really obvious ones: 2001: A Space Odyssey, and Jaws, and Rocky.
Okay, yeah.
So very in that 60s. Rear Window's up there as well somewhere.
Nice, like that, yeah.
Yeah, probably Psycho as well.
Anthony's top 20 is probably the perfect top 20. When you look at like the IMDb top sort of 20s, there's a couple of odd ones in there.
You'll always have something really recent in there.
But Anthony has no anomalies in there, nothing that's off kilter. And
it's been years of hard work,
And you're still working on it now, mate.
I'm still working on it. Oh, hey, look, I got something for you. I was, we obviously know that Reservoir Dogs got the idea of the names of the colors.
Colors, yeah.
But do you know why the four characters have those color names?
Oh, hang on. You're looking it up now.
No.
I'm being totally honest. I didn't get this.
So what were the colours? It was grey was one, wasn't it?
It's nothing to do with the tube lines, is it?
No. Robert Shaw's blue. Martin Balsam's green. Hector Elizondo's grey. And the other fella, Earl Hines, is it? Is brown. Yeah. It's the colour of the hats they're wearing.
Oh, so close. Nice, yeah.
But I've seen this film so many times and I never noticed that. But if you notice, the colour's very kind of washed out, isn't it?
It's not the most brightly coloured film ever.
Yeah,
it?
And it's not like they're wearing bright blue and bright green.
Yeah.
I look really closely and to be honest, you can't even really see even if you're looking for it.
Oh, and Scott's colourblind. Don't help.
Oh, well, I am a little bit as well, to be honest.
Even if I was to watch this after we finished recording, I still probably wouldn't notice.
Vivid colours.
Because very washed out.
Called Mr. Grey when you've got like orange, blue, whatever, and then Reservoir Dogs pink and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
Grey, it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, you're assuming that they don't actually know each other's real names. So to refer to them, it's like, oh, you must be Mr. Grey because you're wearing the grey hat. You must be.
It's a simple note.
Yeah.
So it influenced Reservoir Dogs with that. But have you ever seen a Kubrick film called The Killing, like a really early one with a racehorse?
Recommended to me so many times. I watched it last year. Yeah.
Well, this film took the idea of the masks, wearing the masks. Oh, can I give you my alternative synopsis from Halliwell?
Yes, please.
Did you ever have the Halliwell books?
I did. It was a film.
Really harsh.
He worked for Radio Times, didn't he? I think he did. But what he did, he brought out a book every couple of years and it listed 15,000, 20,000 movies. But it was like literally a three sentence synopsis.
Almost like an almanac of just synopsis.
Oh, very Alan Partridge. Love it.
And wouldn't he give a star rating as well?
Yeah, but he was really harsh. Like, this is in the 80s. He loved black and white film. He loved that era. So he'd give all those ones 4 or 5 stars. And then he'd give really good films 1 star or 2 stars. But from him, like, 1 or 2 stars was a badge of honour. But his synopsis was, a gang of men dressed as Groucho Marx and led by Robert Shaw with the voice of a Dalek hijack a subway train and demand $1 million.
That is brilliant. So terrible, isn't it?
You can hear the Dalek thing because it sort of goes Pelham 123 to command centre. Pelham 123. It's not a million miles away from the Dalek.
It's the
Groucho Marx bit. The
Groucho Marx, yeah. Martin Balsam sneezing so much he keeps having to like push the moustache back.
Yes,
on.
Yes,
well,
yes.
Pelham 123 to command centre. Do you read me? You ready to take down our list of demands now?
I'm listening, you animal. What do you want?
Do you have your pen?
Go on, for Pete's sake.
To begin with, it's important that you understand three things. One, Pelham 123 is completely within our control. Two, we're all armed with automatic weapons. Three, we have no scruples whatsoever about killing. Do you understand me so far?
Oh, I understand you fine, you lunatic. You'll never get away with this, you know.
Please inform the mayor that we demand $1 million cash for the release of the car and all the hostages, right?
That'll be the day.
The time is now 2:13. The money must be in our hands not later than 3:13, 1 hour from now. Now, if the money is not in our hands, we'll kill one hostage for every minute you're late.
Keep dreaming, maniac.
Furthermore, if anybody attempts to interfere, anyone in any way, we will begin killing the hostages immediately. Confirm, please.
Zach! Zach!
Pelham 123, come in, please.
This is Pelham. Identify yourself, please.
Oh, this is Lieutenant Zachary Garber, the Transit Police. Identify yourself, please.
I'm the man who stole your train.
Well, sir, there is no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
Why do you concern yourself with that? At precisely 3:13, we are going to begin executing the hostages. Don't you think you better get in touch with the mayor and get back to me for my further instructions? Over and out.
That son of a bitch has got me backed up all the way to the front. All right, what is this, a circus? Come on, for Christ's sake, let's get back to work.
Rico, did you get that?
I only get your end of it, but I can piece the rest of it together. Jesus, crazy.
Well, the guy who's talking's got a heavy English accent. He could be a fruitcake. We got anybody at 28th Street?
Just checking it out. Yeah, he's around there somewhere.
Right, well, tell him to hold the fort. His line will be all day before the city cops show up. They're never around when you need them.
Yeah, what's weird about it, you don't see Martin Balsam really until the end. Because the others don't look that different from how they really look. But he looks completely different.
Well, Martin Balsam's the key to it, isn't he? Because he's the only one that can drive the train, you know. He's the man that's brought in at the beginning.
Yeah, so the film starts and ends with him.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, just picking that apart. How difficult is it to drive a train that you go forward, speed up a little, slow down a little, stop? It's not like you've got to steer. It's not like you've got to indicate or do anything else.
Wasn't the driver or the motorman or whatever they called him, didn't he say, I never knew these could go backwards or something?
Yeah, yeah, he does.
It's just like...
The fact of the matter is, it's the
dead
key.
Man's handle,
yeah,
isn't it?
Handle he had, yeah. That's the only thing that made him useful. Because, I mean, any bloody idiot could drive a train.
But then also he knew the routines. He knew how... You know, the signals worked you know, the conductor, what his role was,
he sort of knew what the radio or when the radio call would come in and when they'd get suspicious. Yeah.
So they did need him, really. I mean, they needed somebody, you know, same as the great train robbery, you know, they needed to drive. Well, that fell apart completely, that whole the plot. How many times have you seen this, Anthony?
Oh, God knows. Probably about 30 or 40. Don't know.
That's a lot. Okay, now.
But not that much recently. But I knew it. I just felt like I knew it so well.
And you've watched it again for this particular.
Just the other night. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Have you watched it, Paul, since 10 years ago?
Yeah, I watched it Wednesday night.
That was the first time.
Mm. No, I think I've seen it
in between.
In between, yeah.
And this was the first time I think I watched it. Strangely enough,
I watched the remake a couple of months ago as well, which made me, because I've seen that a few times. But again, appreciate the remake. Well, it's not a remake.
It's a different movie.
Rethinking, I think, would be closer thing. You can watch that having never watched this and appreciate that it's a Hollywood action film.
Yes, yes.
That there's bits of the plot that have been changed, which I think sort of worked. The thing is, this film, the 70s version, is a classic. And will always be because it was so beautifully done. There's none of this throwing billions of pounds at it and getting huge actors, whatever. The remake was just one, oh, how can we make some money? Let's make it into an action film. Let's do that. It's not going to be remembered in 10, 20 years as anything other than a half-decent action. So I think that's where the comparisons... I hate it when Hollywood today remake a film almost word for word, and you're thinking, well, why are you doing that? Why are you doing it? I can appreciate if they change it to make a bit of money, or change it because perhaps the CGI has improved so much they can improve a film. But this was... There's no need for any CGI, any big, massive explosions. It was all about the writing. It was all about the plot. It was about the suspense in it. It's a heist movie, which I like. I really love heist movies. And it didn't need to be touched. If you made that again with the same cast and you had all the Hollywood CGI and everything at your disposal, it still should have been made the way it was. I don't think you needed to change it.
I watched a few scenes of a remake of 12 Angry Men recently.
Mm.
And I just thought, it wasn't terrible, but I just thought, this is so unnecessary.
Yep.
Because Pelham, this film, this version we're talking about, it's kind of perfect if you think about it.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's the greatest film in the history of the world, but I mean, you think the music's perfect, the script, the humour, the cynicism, New York... You know, the cast, I can't really think of anyone who would have done it better. It's not to say they're the only people that could have done it. But it's got a certain perfection about it.
Yeah, last night when I watched it, I picked up on the fact that within seconds, and probably not even any dialogue, you knew the character of each of the four main protagonists.
Yes.
Just through their actions, like Hector Elizondo, creepy fuck, you know, because... Yeah. He's like licking
doing that tongue thing, and he squeezes her ass or grabs her knee
or whatever.
You knew he was going to be trigger happy, right?
And then Martin Balsam, you know he's going to be the weaker one because already he's full up with cold or flu or whatever, and he's probably going to be the one that lets them down or whatever, you know. And Robert Shaw, cool, calculating, precise.
Exactly.
And you get that within seconds, and not even a word's been said. It's just their actions and the way they present themselves. Earl Hyman, who plays Mr. Brown.
Mr. Brown, yeah.
See the one with a stutter?
Yeah.
Right, him, you don't get too much. No. You're not too sure. Do you know who Earl Hyman is?
No. I
recognise the face.
Well, you recognise half the face.
Oh. Is he...
The two faces of Dr. Jekyll? I don't know.
Yeah. Did you ever watch Home Improvement?
Oh, the guy peered over the fence.
He's the next door neighbour.
Oh, I did read that. Yeah. I've never seen Home Improvement.
Yeah. Wilson?
Yeah, something like that.
He's the next door neighbour.
Oh, yeah. Well, I never thought I'd see the day when talking to murderers took priority over running a railroad.
Get out of it, will you, Frank? My only priority is saving the lives of these passengers.
Screw the goddamn passengers. What the hell they expect for that lousy 35 cents to live forever?
Oh, yeah, beautiful. You read me, Pelham, 1, 2, 3.
If I was running things, I'd win there with guns and tear gas and blast them out.
Yeah, well, you're not running things, so why don't you start doing your own work and let the police do theirs, huh?
Like that lily-livered cop on the train, huh? When the hell's he going to start shooting?
You don't even know if it is or he. Do you read me, Pelham, 1, 2, 3?
What the hell good are they? Probably can't find her goddamn purse.
Pelham, 1, 2, 3, any news to report?
What's that about news? You say again about news.
I said, have you any news to report?
Oh, no, nothing yet. Gesundheit.
What are you calling about?
Pelham, we need more time.
Shut the door, please, Fred. It is 2:24, Lieutenant. You've got 49 minutes left.
Be reasonable, will you? We're trying to cooperate with you, but we can't do anything if you don't give us enough time to work with.
49 minutes.
We're dealing with City Hall, for God's sake. You know what a mess of red tape that is?
49 minutes.
Look, fella, we know how to tell time here as well as you do, but we aren't going to get any place if all you do is repeat 49 minutes.
48 minutes.
Yeah, all right. We'll get back to you as soon as we can.
Christ, to hear you plead with that chicken shit makes me ashamed of being American.
Yeah, will you, Frank? Go play with your train.
Well, I've noticed in heist films, you always get the leader who's the sort of a bit, not intellectual, but a thoughtful, the thinker.
Yeah,
who's got it all worked out. Then you've always got the loose cannon,
mm-hmm.
who could potentially blow it all.
It's a blueprint, isn't there, of how to make a perfect heist.
There is, but then they've tweaked it. You know, they like Mark Kimo's done that series, Secrets of Cinema, which I really recommend. He did one on He did one on heist films, and he said what you have to do, you take the formula and then you tweak it each time. You know, and a couple of things with Mr. Green, Martin Balsam. Did you notice in the script he says to Robert Shaw twice, "I'm going to die today."
Yes.
Yeah.
The irony being he's the only one of the four that doesn't die. It's just little things like that, which are really clever, you know, and you wouldn't really notice them. But the sneezing thing, this is based on a novel, which I actually have just ordered. I've never read it. I'm gonna read it. And do you remember when we did Deliverance? There's a little link here. Do you remember in the novel of Deliverance, even though we haven't read it, we were saying there's a lot of backstory.
Yeah.
But if a film is skillful, you can tell all the backstory with a few lines. And that's what you were just saying. You know these guys. You get a bit of backstory, like Robert Shaw's a mercenary, and obviously Martin Balsam reckons he was framed, you know, because he was sacked.
Yeah.
And the other guy was thrown out the mafia. Yeah. But it's very clever. Yeah. It's very economical. Yeah.
But why South Ferry?
Well, do you think it's the water, Rico? Maybe they got a boat in the harbor or a seaplane or something.
I don't know. We better play it one step at a time. Lieutenant Garber, you see about restoring the power and clearing the tracks.
And I'll start pulling our units out of the tunnel. We can follow them just as well on the street.
Except how do we know where they'll be?
A Grand Central Tower has them on their model boards. We can see every move they make. They stop any place before South Ferry, we know about it.
I'll check in when I get to my car.
Wait a minute. I think I just figured out how they're going to get away.
I'm listening.
They're going to fly the train to Cuba.
You're a sick man, Rico.
For Christ's sake, what do you want me to do? The power's still off. You'll have to move on my bus. What do you mean you haven't got any buses? Go out and hijack some. Hey, Garber, what's going on? Do I get my trains back now or don't I, huh?
You don't, not yet.
Jesus, do you realize a goddamn rush hour starts in an hour?
Can you shut up for a minute and listen to me? I got a new set of instructions.
I don't give a rat's ass to your fucking instructions. I'm not lifting a finger to help the killers of Kaz Dalowitz. Hey!
Now, you listen to me, you dumb son of a bitch. You don't do what I tell you, you'll be having dinner tonight with Kaz Dalowitz.
Jesus Christ, what are you...
It wouldn't be a Stinking Paws or a Real Britannia with you as a guest, mate, without trying to find a link to the Beatles.
Oh, yes.
The line. Now, I'm going to throw the challenge out to you. You said you didn't think about it for this
point. No, I didn't, no. Some reason I associated with the Sunday morning ones.
I found a very, very loose, it's almost like a 6 degrees of separation type thing. Do you want me to tell you?
Yeah.
Okay. The guy that plays Inspector Daniels, the big, tall, black guy, Julius Harris
from Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. Who recorded the theme tune?
Oh, yes, of course.
God, that's tenuous.
That's the only one I could find.
Well, sorry, go on.
No, there must be more, but I can't think of them. Yeah.
While we're talking about Julius Harris, we've got two Bond villains in this film. So Robert Shaw was obviously from Russia with Love.
Yeah,
I'm taking all the credit for this, even though I read it on IMDb. Nothing I say is original, okay.
We need to mention as well, Nathan George, the cop that is in the tunnel.
Yes.
You know, the first cop that goes in the tunnel and sees everything.
Yeah, I'm not that easy to see in the dark.
Yeah, that's him. Yeah, the great line. You'd never get away with it now.
It for black guys.
That's fine. You can, yeah. Back in the early days of Stinking Paws, you're fully aware of Real Britannia, my other podcast, where we do the Village Hall of Fame. We started a Hall of Fame with Stinking Paws in the early days, you know, and it just got lost because there were so many movies and nobody sort of took responsibility for it and it fell by the wayside. Nathan George, the guy that plays that cop, was one of the first inductees.
Oh, right.
You know, like in Real Britannia, it's always like the lesser known actors that get inducted into the Hall of Fame. Nathan George came in because of 1, 2, 3, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Clute. He's in all three of those.
Oh, is he one of the hospital like hands in Waffle's Nest?
He plays a character called Washington. So I'm not.
Yeah, sure. One of the guys who works with Nurse Ratched. Yeah. Oh, I didn't tweak that.
Yeah, and he was one of our very first inductees into the Stinking Paws Hall of Fame, because he appeared three times within about 6 months. And, you know, like same as Real Britannia, you know, we expected it to be the big guns, you know, that would always be like Robert De Niro or Al Pacino or someone like that. And Nathan George, our first inductee 10 years ago in the Hall of Fame was David Morse.
David Morse.
You're going to have to look him up on IMDb. He was in St. Elsewhere originally.
Yeah, and we had him in, he was in Rock, wasn't he?
He was in The Rock. He got inducted because of The Rock, Long Kiss Goodnight, and something else.
He's always one. He usually plays someone from the army or the police, and he's always
crooked. Always big. Yeah.
He's not as big as a supporting actor, but he's sort of somewhere.
He's B.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was some of the first movies.
Can we stay on the cast? Because obviously we've got Jerry Stiller.
Yes, we were talking about him earlier, yeah.
Yeah, but I've got another one. You know the motorman, Doyle?
Yes.
His son is Matthew Broderick.
Oh, I just read it. James Broderick, yeah. Oh, okay.
Quite weird to have two Hollywood stars' dads in this film. Quite weird.
So many famous faces, but they're not super famous faces, you know what I mean? They're just like faces of that era that you see in every 70s movie.
And then you got Tony Roberts was in loads of Woody Allen films, as we know.
Yeah.
As the deputy mayor. That all that stuff with the mayor is fantastic. Because notice the mayor's got a cold as well. How weird is that?
Well, that's what they said. There's like flu going around, don't they?
So yeah.
Awesome struck with it. The mayor's struck down with it.
He's like, I'm not getting out of this bed.
He's watching the Newlyweds on TV, isn't he? That's like we had Mr. and Mrs. That's it, isn't it?
That was it. And then he missed the end of it.
What do you think?
Well, we're fully mobilized. I can go down there anytime you say with enough firepower to wipe out an army. But I can't guarantee the safety of the hostages.
In other words, you're for paying the ransom.
Well, we don't want another Attica, do we?
So your vote is?
I abstain.
Shit. Bonnie? The safety of the passengers is the only concern of the Transit Authority.
Your vote?
Pay the $2.
$2. $2. If it was $2, I'd pay the $2, Bonnie. It's a million. It's a one with six zeros. Now tell me, is it coming out of your pocket? Come on, Sid. Will you save the poor mouth for later? How do you vote?
I'm not through discussing it yet.
Yes, you are. Now vote.
My concern is with the taxpayers. I mean, somebody's orderly. You know what I always say? Millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute. Isn't that what I always say?
Uh-huh. So that's a no. All right, Al. You've heard from the three wise men. Now, what do you say?
What are they going to say, Warren?
They who?
Who? Everybody. The press, the man on the street.
He means the voters.
You know what they're going to say. The Times is going to support you. The News is going to knock you. The Post will take both sides at the same time. The rich will support you. Likewise, the blacks and the Puerto Ricans won't give a shit. So come on, Al. Quit stalling.
Will you stop bullying everybody, Warren? This is supposed to be a democracy.
Why is that, for Christ's sake? We're trying to run a city, not a goddamn democracy. Al, quit farting around. We've got to pay.
Jesse? Jesse, what do you say?
I know $1 million sounds like a lot of money, but just think what you're going to get in return.
What?
18 sure votes.
All right. All right, Warren. Warren, arrange for the payoff.
Hallelujah. All right, fellas, you heard it. Phil, pass the word to the bad guys that we're coughing up. Sid, what bank do we do the most business with?
City National Trust. I'll give them a call.
I'll call. You'll take an hour trying to knock down the interest rate.
Jesse, I think I handled it all right, huh?
A regular Fiorella LaGuardia.
It's silly little things like this because it is so serious, this movie, but then you get these little light-hearted touches, mainly from Walter Matthau's sort of aside comments, but the mayor is just hilarious throughout.
Yeah, he's definitely in there for a bit of comedy value because he says, I don't want to go down there, they'll throw things at me, they'll boo me.
Yeah, and he does get booed in the end, doesn't he? Yeah, he does turn up at the end.
So is this the year of like Giuliani, 74, or are we a bit early for that?
No, Giuliani was around 9/11, wasn't he? No, it was Mayor Lindsay, because it's a time when New York was going bankrupt, wasn't it?
And we've got all the corrupt cops and all that sort of stuff. You know, that's the era I'm sort of thinking of.
Oh, here's some weird trivia. Here we go.
Yeah.
You know where they arrive at the subway station with the money? There's two guys who go, I feel like I'm walking into the fucking OK Corral.
Yeah.
When they're walking, just when they get in the subway station, apparently, again, I didn't spot this at all. Across the street, you can see a cafe, which is the cafe and taxi driver where they would, where they'd all meet between shifts. Oh. Yeah. Right. So it's a nice little link there because, again, this is obviously another New York film.
Yeah.
They had French Connection, Taxi Driver, Midnight Cowboy. That's another thing, you know, not only Heist and Robert Shaw, but I love New York films as well.
Well, I noticed they went through 59th Street and instantly I thought of Simon and Garfunkel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then, where is Pelham? It's Pelham Park, isn't it?
Pelham Parkway, I think.
Yeah. What is that? I mean, that's just part of New York that I'm not immediately familiar with.
It's the name of the station.
It's like if you would go London Underground, it's just a station at the end of a particular line.
Got it here. It's Pelham Parkway. It's in the Bronx, working in middle class residential neighbourhood in the centre of the Bronx.
Yeah.
It's just where trains set off from. It would be like, I don't know, Central Line, Epping Forest, end of the line, or Loughton or whatever.
Yeah, commuter country sort of thing. And that's the whole thing is it's Pelham is the starting point at 123.
I like the way they named that because, I mean, you look at the title and think Pelham 123.
Doesn't mean
it's like one, two, three.
It should.
Do you think they name London tube trains? They don't, do they?
No, they're just called. I don't know, they're not even called that.
King's Cross 423.
They don't, do they? Because, obviously on the Circle Line, there's no chance of it.
They might in the control room.
Yeah. Mm. Also, Mattel says to the Tokyo guys, this is the largest underground subway system network in the world.
Yeah.
Is that true? Because I thought the London.
No, ours is the oldest.
Right.
It's not necessarily the largest. It might be now because it's branched off.
Yeah.
It's funny that you get all that information about the subway as well. It's quite interesting. You get all this trivia.
No, isn't it though? When you think about it, it's the stuff he says.
Yeah.
Helps you understand what's going on in the movie when he explains why it's called Pelham 123. He doesn't use Pelham 123, he uses a different tube, different station and time.
Yeah.
And it gives you sort of a background onto how things work and who the other people are, you know, because you've got this separate little control room right in the heart of the by the line itself with Paul, the black lady that's been obviously drafted in.
Damn, she was a handsome woman.
I didn't notice this. Paul said to me, God, she was ugly. I'm like, I didn't notice. But all I noticed was the banter between everybody because they were so pissed off that there was a woman
It was obvious that she'd only just come in. It's the 70s. They're starting to get a bit of women's rights or whatever, equality. Yeah. And she was the token female in the office.
A black female, of course.
But
that whole sort of demographic and the interaction between those guys there, like you said, with the lights that are going on. What's going on here? Why is he doing that? And then the controller's getting really angry. He's like, I'm going to bust his ass. I'm going to give him another ticket.
Kasdolowitz, what a character. The guy, he gets shot. The one who gets shot,
yeah.
And it's a great line. He goes, how can you run a subway without swearing? Because he's swearing in front of the woman. And then the other guy, is he called Frank? The one that Walter Matthau ends up sort of nearly punching.
Yeah.
He says, they said something about saving the passengers. And he goes, what do they expect for their lousy 35 cents to live forever? So there's this brilliantly cynical edge to it all, isn't there?
I was quite surprised they didn't let the kids off the tube.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but if you're thinking as a person committing this, kids are more valuable.
That's true.
Because old people that you'd think, oh, let them off, they're only old. Yeah, you would, but like the kids, the press is going to have a field day if there's kids murdered on the train rather than just adults.
That woman, she says, excuse me, can I go too, she says, because I got an important appointment.
Yeah, the hooker. And he goes, she's a 20 buck a trick hooker, and he goes, listen, you little prick, 20 bucks wouldn't buy you a good night kiss. And what about the sleeping woman?
Just leave her there.
Yeah.
And it wakes up at the end and goes, 42nd Street already?
That's brilliant. I mean, anyone that works in London or lived in London has done that. Yeah. I used to work in London when I was 18, and my brother lived in Loughton. And I'd stay there some, if I was drinking in the week, and I'd stay there rather than going all the way back to Kent. And yeah, I've woken up in Epping Forest, which is a couple of stops past that before.
But no one's hijacked Epping Forest, surely.
Not yet.
I'll tell you what it reminded me of as well. You don't get a great deal of insight into the characters of the passengers, but you get some, right? You get some sort of idea of who they are and what they do and what they're all about.
Yeah.
Almost like, you know, like a disaster movie where they bring a whole group of people together.
Yeah,
sort of disparate people, yeah.
Yeah, and you sort of get to know them before the disaster happens. Well, what happens with this? The disaster happens first.
Yes.
And then you meet the people that are involved.
Yeah.
Or caught up in it afterwards.
Yeah, because there's a lady that's Hispanic and will only speak Spanish and have to translate sort of what.
Yeah.
And obviously the mother with the two kids who are being right little annoying brats.
Yeah.
And the old man's having a bit of banter with Robert Shaw, isn't he? You know.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how much you're getting and what's going to happen if you don't get what you want?
To be honest, if you were on that train being held hostage, I want to know what I'm worth.
Yeah, why not?
$500,000 in 50s, $500,000 in 100s, right?
500,000 in 50s, 500,000 in 100s, right?
Which will then be put in stacks of 200 bills each, bound with two thick elastic bands.
Two stacks of bills bound in what?
Bound with thick elastic bands. Point two, all of the bills will be old bills. Their serial numbers to be random. Now that's all. When the delivery arrives, we'll contact you with further instructions, right?
About what, your getaway?
Signing off now.
Son of a bitch. It's a bit crazy.
Hey, Pelham, might interest you to know I figured out how you're going to do it.
Yes, it would interest me very much.
You're going to make every man, woman, and child in New York City close their eyes and count to 100, right?
It is now 2:47. That means you have got 26 minutes.
Hey, wait a minute, pal. Wait a minute. We agreed to pay you the money. Now turn your clock off, will you?
26 minutes.
Look, pal, your instructions were complicated. The money has to be counted, stacked, tied, transported uptown. It just isn't physically possible.
You'd be surprised what's physically possible. Your clock's running.
26 minutes. After that, we can start scratching them off one per minute.
Your attention, please. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd interest you to know the city of New York has agreed to pay for your release.
As soon as the money gets here, will you let us go?
Soon after.
Excuse me, sir. Would you mind telling us now how much you're getting?
Why is that of interest to you, sir?
Well, a person likes to know his worth.
$1 million.
That's not so terrible.
Oh, one other little bit of trivia, you might not be surprised about this, but the Transit Authority wouldn't schedule any train from Pelham going at 1-2-3, which is like it's kind of like hotels not having a room 237, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing.
13 floors and things.
And Hector Elizondo had this weird story that he went to a shop. There was Mr. Gray. He was Mr. Gray. Yeah. He went to a shop and the woman wouldn't serve him, and it's because she'd seen the film the night before. I'm not sure I buy that, but it's a good story.
The only other thing I know Hector Elizondo for, he's the hotel manager in Pretty Woman.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, the one that sort of takes her under his wing, sort of like, sort of understands what Julia Roberts is all about.
Oh, I've seen him in a lot of TV, I think.
But that's the one that sticks out for me.
You can see him as a
Princess Diaries.
Is what, sorry?
Princess Diaries.
You watched that, did you, Paul?
I might have seen that.
What did you think of the music?
So 70s.
Yeah, I love it.
Especially right at the start, there's that, you know, the slapping of the bass. Bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a little bit... Go on, sorry.
No, I said you know what you're going to get immediately as soon as those credits roll, and you've got that almost bit like Isaac Hayes, or, you know, that sort of like typical 70s.
Yeah, it's quite blaxploitation, isn't it?
Yeah.
But don't you think the music kind of drives, it's a bit like the subway train, it's kind of driving along. That's one thing I liked. When they were counting the money, you know, in the middle, they're getting the ransom together and the music kind of drives it along. You know? I thought it was perfect.
I did like the fact with the money that they were very realistic with how $1 million looks.
Yes, yes.
There's so many movies, especially heist movies, you've got $1 million and it's a sort of 3 foot square block of bills. Yeah. And you're thinking, if it's $1 bills, maybe. But when you think if they're $100 bills, you've only got, 10,000 of them for $1 million.
And also, they divided into certain amounts, and they say, right, how many of those each do we get? Don't they? They know
18
that I'm going to get.
Each, it was.
And they put it out on the train, don't they? That guy goes, all the passengers are kind of gasping. I think, I wouldn't mind $1 million. Yeah,
especially in 74.
Yeah. Oh, that's it, yeah.
Of course, it's 35 cents just for a journey on the tube, and there's $1 million.
Yeah, jeez, bloody hell. Well, I was just looking through the cast. The director, Joseph Sargent, did a wonderful job, but he was the director of Jaws: The Revenge. But I'm going to forgive him. I'm going to forgive him because he did such a good job here. Now, just the pacing and everything, it's just so, I think, like I say, it's kind of a perfect film for me. Not to say it's the greatest film ever, but it's, for what it's doing, I mean, what could you really fault?
But also, mate, it probably got you at the right time.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I fully admit it's heart over head a little bit, you know.
We've said this before, haven't we? There's movies you can watch, and they just strike you. You know, you've watched them at the right time in your life, and it's going to stick with you for the rest of your life. And there's been occasions where I've gone back to movies that I hadn't seen before that everybody raves about from the 70s or the 80s, but I think I missed that point where it would have been relevant to me, and it's just like, oh, no, that doesn't work. You know, if I'd have watched that in 83, 84, that would have been brilliant. Yeah. But look, you've had a couple of those. I mean, Marrow for Man didn't work for you, did it?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, that's interesting.
I wasn't blown away by that, no.
Paul'd never seen it, and we reviewed it a few weeks back, and I thought Paul would love it because it's got all the elements there that make a great movie that you
New York again, played. New York again.
Yeah. And you were just left a little bit cold by it.
I could understand why people sort of liked it at the time, but I just don't think it had enough, I don't know, structure, enough depth in what was happening. And it didn't explain itself fully. It left a lot to like you finding out much later in the film what was actually going on in the first part of the film, and which to me left it a bit disjointed. But again, I didn't hate the film. It's not a Mildred Pierce or anything.
I've heard about that.
Again, Stinking Paul's legend.
Don't do it.
We have this running thing. Like whenever we pick a film, one of these films that I love, one of my big favourites, it's always the same story. I watched it when I was 14. Watched it about 400 times. Recorded it off the telly. Absolutely killed it, and then didn't watch it for 30 years.
Yeah.
I remembered every line. I mean, I was watching this the other night. I pretty much remembered every line. Not that I'd be able to quote it verbatim, but, you know, there was nothing in that I hadn't seen apart from the colour of the hats. I'm ashamed of that. But, no, but it's just, they're so ingrained, and I was so obsessive in those days. Nowadays, I don't watch anything more than once. It's weird. It's gone the completely other way. Yeah. But those days, I would latch on to a film, and I would just watch it to death, just completely kill it. I
think we all done that because we had the old VCRs that you could record off the TV.
Yeah.
you didn't have the opportunity to access a wide library of films.
Yes, yes.
So you would. It'd be like you'd watch it once and you'd go, your mates, did you see this? No, I didn't. Right, come round tomorrow night, we'll watch it. So you watched it for a second time. Yeah. And then you'd do the same with other mates and you'd all sort of get into this almost club of, if you found a movie, I'd done it with Monty Python and Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Because one of my mates' dads sort of said, watch this. And we watched it at a party, like sort of as everyone had gone home and there's about half a dozen people sleeping over. Sort of you just stuck it on at like 1-2 o'clock in the morning. And then it was just like, oh, we got to watch that again. And it spreads from that, doesn't it?
Mm.
Because you've not got Netflix, you've not got Amazon Prime or whatever.
Mm.
And you just, it's like your favorite TV show. You just watch the episodes time and time again. Mine was like one point, Red Dwarf.
That was like Only Fools and Horses. I've
never watched Red Dwarf. My mate loved it. He lent me the videos. And you know the videos, when videos sort of got into the 90s, you could record twice the amount on one video.
Yeah,
you
long
could,
play or whatever.
Yeah,
long play and short play.
Yeah, that's just brought back.
God, it just brought me back.
Yeah.
And the quality would be like half fucking shit.
Yeah, and especially when you've watched it 20 times, the quality was shocking. But he'd recorded every episode of Red Dwarf, and like I just watched them back to back, like going on. So you had 6 hours on one VHS sort of thing.
To the three.
Yeah.
Oh, God, what a treat. Yeah, that was like... That was incredible those days, wasn't it?
Kids, you never knew the things we had to suffer to watch a bloody movie,
Wow. Yeah, because my mum, in our family, we have this running joke that my mum had this habit of recording things over our favourite films.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd be in the middle of watching The Deer Hunter and just get to the most dramatic moment, then you hear, Neighbours! Or,
Back in the 80s, early... 80s, there was a TV show called Number 73.
I remember with Sandy
Tosvik.
Yeah.
All right. Gillingham used to have a TVS studios.
Right.
And they done an outside broadcast from there. Some people from my school were invited down to watch it. There was only like a 10-minute part of the thing. And whilst we were there, they came into the audience and said, right, we're going to be recording the whole show from Gillingham for 4 weeks because Southampton studios were being revamped. Right. Does anyone want to be on it? And I'm like 11 years old. Yeah, I'll be on it, sort of thing. So a couple of months later, they done this and I was on Number 73 for the whole show, like being the little kids that open the blinds or close them so you could watch the things. And I was on there with the great Soprendo as he done his magic tricks and whatever. I was on there with Tenpole Tudor, Swords of a Thousand Men.
Clang,
the name dropping.
And of course, my mum, being the proud mum she was, recorded it. And then about 2 years later, Coronation Street found its way onto that tape.
I've tried
that the episode I'm on. There's a clip on YouTube of Tenpole Tudor on there, but not of me anyway. It's only about 10 minutes of the whole two-hour show.
Paul told me about this about 6 months ago, and I scoured the whole of YouTube for him as well. So this is a general request out to our listeners. If anybody has got – what's the – you know the date, don't you?
I mean, if you Google Number 73 – Tenpole Tudor, it comes up with the episode number.
So if anybody's got any more than
love to know. Like me as this innocent, sweet little blonde 11-year-old boy.
Yeah, look at you.
Yeah, definitely not blonde anymore. Or innocent. Yeah, that one.
Any more to add about Pelham?
Lots. Yeah.
Go for it.
I've got one. I'm gonna
go on. Go on.
Going to out-trivia him. originally considered to direct it was Steven Spielberg.
Oh, right.
That's not long after Sugarland Express.
That would have been.
Didn't
he do the one with the truck in it?
Jewel, 71, Jewel. 72. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't a cinema film, was that? That was a TV film, and they released it. Oh, I love that film. That's a good one.
Yes.
Now, they had a lot of trouble as well, because they were obviously underground. There was a lot of coal dust and rats. Apparently, there were rats the size of cats. They were just these enormous rats. And I've got here the TA, the Transport Authority, required the producers take out $20 million, again, in 1974, in insurance policies, in addition to a $250,000 fee for use of the track, station, subway cars and TA personnel. And they also demanded that there would be no graffiti in the underground. And, of course, in reality, it's just full of graffiti. So they were laughing about it, you know.
Must have been an effort to make sure there's no graffiti in it.
Yeah.
I'm assuming a lot of this was done on location, but there must have been some studio work, like the control rooms must have been in the studio.
The tracks must have been in that day and age, to make up a set that has a tube station in, it's not worth it.
It's got to be recorded on location, isn't it?
Yeah, do it in the middle of the night. Yeah.
That was the other thing that stood out for me. All the interior sets of the control, no windows. Because they're all underground.
Because it would be.
No outside view. Is there any, apart from like the cops and that, you know, there's not many outside views of New York at all.
Oh, just going on with the cops, just something that just caught my eye. When the police are transporting the money in their very 70s police cars.
Mm.
The amazing suspension on those cars. the wheels are bouncing away. They go over a curb, the wheel bounces, but the actual chassis does not move 1 millimeter. And that's something they kept in the remake, is that there's a crash on the way to get the money. But it's like, you don't realize until you sort of hear this, it's how big New York is, because he's thinking, well, they're only going from here to here. Blue lights going and that, it should only take him a couple of minutes.
There's a bit of suspension of disbelief.
Yeah, but then again, that's like going from, say, Croydon in South London to Trafalgar Square sort of thing.
Yeah, with a clear route, hammering it.
Still 20-30 minutes, probably.
The chances are, it's not like it's nighttime. It is the middle of the day. It's coming, as I keep saying, it's coming up for rush hour.
Yeah, exactly.
These streets are packed.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a bit where he goes, oh, you've got 30 seconds more, and then they still crash.
Yeah.
And then they somehow, but Garber's really smart, isn't he? Because they sort of say, oh, they don't know what's going on under them. He says, oh, the money's arrived. That's exactly. The clever bit.
There's that light bulb moment, isn't it? Yeah.
It's very clever, isn't it? Yeah. I like all that stuff where the car crashed. That was a bit French Connection, you know, that the famous car chase?
Yes, yeah.
It was a bit of that, because it seemed like street level for a lot of it. And then it was just kind of a wide shot.
Street approaching has the place. Hold on. You've still got 28 blocks. Floor the son of a bitch.
What do you mean it's been wrecked? There's no more time left. We're out of time.
I know we're out of time.
What do you expect me to do? Couldn't make it, that's all.
What do you mean that's all? They're just about to shoot an innocent person, sir.
How can they do that? If they know the truck is wrecked, how can they expect us to be on time?
They don't know anything down there. How can they know anything where they are? Oh, mackerel, that's it. Tell them 1, 2, 3, the money has arrived. Repeat, the money has arrived. Do you read me, Pelham 1, 2, 3? The money has arrived.
This is Pelham 1, 2, 3. You made it just in time, didn't you?
Get it up there! Move!
I hope it works.
Are you still there, Garber?
Still here. Hey, tell me something, Pelham. If we were a couple of seconds late, you mean you would have knocked off an innocent party?
Affirmative. Now I'm going to give you the instructions for the delivery of the money. As usual, you'll follow them to the letter, okay?
I got it. Go ahead.
Two unarmed policemen.
Gesundheit.
Two unarmed policemen will walk down the track, one the money, the other with a torch, which he will flash continuously from side to side.
When they reach the car, the rear door will be opened, and the one with the money will throw it onto the floor of the train. Then they will both turn, and they will walk back to 28th Street Station. Acknowledge.
I got it. Is that all?
Yeah, that's all for now, but you keep in mind, won't you, the same ground rules apply. Any wrong move by anyone, and I kill a hostage.
Could have guessed that part.
You have got 5 minutes to deliver this money.
Hey, you don't really think you're going to get out of there, do you?
It's now 3:14. You've got till 3:19.
Over.
Over.
How does the director go from this to Jaws the Revenge?
I know, well, that's 13 years.
I don't know that I've ever seen George the Revenge.
George the Revenge.
That would be better, I think.
The shark's name was George.
It was Bruce in the original, but George
Well, Paul, we did a show about Michael Caine. We were just saying, Jaws the Revenge got a perfectly logical
plot. One. Was it one with Michael Caine?
Yes.
Yeah.
You have.
Yeah.
He was saying it's a perfectly logical plot. So the shark was killed in the first film by Brody, Roy Scheider. And the shark's part of a family. And they get together under the water and they say, oh, he killed my cousin. So they journey all the way from America to wherever the Fiji or wherever it's there. They got vendetta. Lorraine Gary, I mean, she must have got paid a lot for agreeing to that.
His wife, wasn't she? The producer's wife.
But for the fourth film, surely her to actually buy that. Yeah, that's plausible. Yeah, how did he get from this to that?
Yeah,
but then money, isn't it?
Yeah, money, exactly. Yeah, I think that's it.
What else? I haven't looked this up. Is he noted for anything else apart from those two movies?
No, I was looking through. I can't see anything.
I mean, there
might have been a couple I've seen. I was just going to say, Martin Balsam is one of those actors. He got himself into loads of key films, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the big one.
Tell me the ones you know him from.
The big one I think of is Psycho. He's the cop.
Yeah, Psycho. Killed on the Stairs. 12 Angry Men. He's the
12 Angry Men, yeah.
Cape Fear.
I'd never seen 12 Angry Men. And Scott, I think it was your choice.
It was one day, yeah.
And that's when Liam was still coming.
Yeah,
as well.
Liam was with us that day. Yeah.
And we both like, oh, it's some really old
shit 50s film that Scott's picked. Yeah,
and we both absolutely adored the film. It's just such a great film. Suspenseful and so manipulative in the way it changes throughout.
It's just all in one room.
Yeah, but that's. I like films that don't sort of change sets, the ones that are just on the acting rather than where it's set. Like Phone Booth, for instance. Have you ever seen Phone Booth?
Yeah, a long time ago it came out.
That is just set on the street. It's like one phone box.
Yep.
And it's just the plot and the acting that made the film so special.
Oh, Rear Window, obviously.
Yeah,
James Stewart's acting against nothing really, you know. The people weren't there when he was watching them, you know, when they were filming it. Yeah. I know Balsam was in Breakfast and Tiffany's, Cape Fear, Catch 22, Murder on the Orient Express, All the President's Men as well.
Oh God.
And he wasn't really the star. I can't think of a film where he was actually the lead.
Nothing, mate. There's nothing.
He just got himself, he's the typical character actor, they call it, don't they?
But dependable, just reliable.
Totally, yeah, completely dependable, yeah.
Sorry, I'm just looking through the director's work.
Yes.
There is just nothing I've heard of. But
I'm surprised.
There is this great picture of a film called...
Tripped Over or Jumped from the Train, like that. Just a big cloud of dust and people got sick and... The crew were wearing masks, which is very topical, obviously, for the last few years.
Clear then as well before they...
Of course. I mean, it just sounds like movie making, if you really read into it too much, just sounds like more hassle than it's worth. As I've got older, I'll be honest, I can see why Hollywood goes for formula. Because there's so much risk involved, you know what I mean? That if you think the public are going to buy a formula film, then You know, why not in one way?
Saying about dust and that, it must be like that film in any Western. You think, yeah, out in the desert and whatever, and it just must be, you've got to rely on the weather. You've got to rely on the winds. Yeah, it's just, they must lose so many days filming to the elements.
Oh, of course, yeah. Well, with Jaws, I mean, you probably know this, but the problem was the sailboats in the background. So they set the shot up and then a sailboat would appear. And they'd have a choice of either rotating everything 90 degrees, which would probably take about 45 minutes, or waiting for the sailboats to go by, which would take about 45 minutes. And, but then they got to hope that another one wouldn't come along, you know.
Yeah, and also there's supposed to be so many miles out to sea, but they were filming literally half a mile offshore. So
well, you can see the shore, can't you?
Yeah.
But as we said, Scott, I mean, Richard Dreyfuss is very tight-lipped. I mean, he never talks about
it. He never talks about Jaws, does he?
Never know anything about it. The shark is not working. Now, Paul, Richard Dreyfuss, it's like McCartney. There's a Beatles thing. It's like McCartney talking about the Beatles, like every fucking 5 minutes. Oh, yeah, the Beatles, that was great. You know, John broke up the group. You know, it's, we joke about that a lot.
70s film for you?
Yeah.
American Graffiti.
I've got my selection for next time. I've just found it.
All right.
Yeah.
Have you?
Yes. And it's linked to this in a way.
Right.
It's a remake. No, we're not going to do it. No. The Titfield Thunderbolt we're going to do.
Do you want me to keep this going?
Anthony, come on, let's finish off these copious notes, my friend.
Oh, just loads and loads of great lines. When they meet Rico Petrone, who's Jerry Stiller, Ben Stiller's dad, and he's just sort of sitting with his feet up reading the paper, and he's got the Japanese, the friends of the chairman. He goes, tell us about some of the things that have happened. He goes, we had a bomb scare in the Bronx, but it turned out to be a cantaloupe.
A cantaloupe, yeah.
It's stuff like that.
Random shit.
Yeah. Yeah, the sneezing, that whole thing, it wasn't in the book. I don't know whoever, obviously the writer came up with that. Yeah, brilliant device.
I think it's brilliant because who's the person's gun you often say about in a movie?
Chekhov's gun.
It was that, because right in the very first scene, he sneezes. And that is literally the last thing you hear at the end.
And he says Gesundheit. That's the other thing.
Opens the door again, doesn't he, and looks at him.
What, where were you this afternoon, Mr. Longman?
Why?
You tell me where, I tell you why.
Right here.
Can anyone verify that fact?
You said you'd tell me why.
You were here all afternoon?
Asleep in the afternoon.
All afternoon?
Well, until about an hour ago.
But you heard about the hijacking, huh?
What hijacking?
The subway train.
So? You got to be kidding.
Do I look like I'm kidding? I mean, would I be here if I was kidding, Mr.?
Subway. I wouldn't want to do a thing like that.
Hey, Zeke, you got a match?
No. You got a warrant?
No.
The Supreme Court says you have to have a warrant unless I'm under arrest.
Oh, yeah? Well, the way things are going, they're going to be changing that in about 10 minutes.
Mr. Longman, you got a match?
No.
That's all right. I'll get it at the stove.
Huh? I'll get it.
It's a little tricky.
A tendency to explode here. Come on, Rico, let's go. Yeah.
Thanks, Mr. Longman.
Go on, Mr. Longman. We'll be back later.
Yeah? Listen, I know I got a gripe with it, yeah. I know I got a bum rap, but I wouldn't do anything as stupid as what you just told me. What do you think, I'm a jerk? Just do me a big favor, will you? Get the hell out of here, for Christ's sake.
Come on, Mr. Longman. We have to follow our leads. It's our job.
Yeah, big deal. Look, I got my rights. This is my home. I want a little peace. Well, just do me a little favor, will you? Get the hell out of here.
Sorry if we bothered you, Mr. Longman.
Come on, Rico.
Gesundheit.
And it's like, you know who's been collared for that.
Again, it's set up, isn't it? If you're going to show it in the first chapter, make sure you resolve it by whatever chapter later.
But that's the thing, it wasn't telegraphed. Like, I never knew that was coming.
Oh, subtle. Very
subtle. It's not like in Hollywood now where they have a line they repeat, don't they? Yeah. Someone will say a line and then they'll have to repeat it later on. They didn't go down that road.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing about it is that, like I say, with Martin Balsam, you never see him. He's so heavily disguised, I think, that when you finally see him and he's got the money and all that bit.
Yeah.
I mean, there was one funny bit, just to pick holes. That last scene, he's acting so suspiciously. Have you ever seen anyone be less suspicious?
Yeah, yeah. I've been sleeping and then he sees the money lying on the floor and he sneaks back and kicks it under the bed sort of thing.
And when they arrive against the police, he goes, wait a minute, wait a minute. And obviously they can hear everything.
Well, it's almost like Scrooge McDuck, isn't he? He's just lying on his feet.
It's brilliant though, isn't it? But it's funny how it's very clever how it all, like I said earlier, it starts and ends with him.
Yeah,
It's weird, isn't it? Really, it's kind of his. It's kind of his story in a way, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's a good way of looking at it because
it starts with a sneeze and ends with a sneeze.
Yeah, and it's no particular person's story, is it? But then Martin Balsam is the key all the way through. So
you'd say like if there was going to be an award, he would have been supporting actor, wouldn't he?
Yeah,
because. Mm.
Matow would have been lead.
Matow and Shaw joint lead. Probably Shaw, and him was the supporting. But it's just, especially at the end, he's all got this, he's got less hair, it's all greased back. He's living in a really shitty little flat. And when he walks through it, you're thinking, what the fuck is the layout of this flat? It's all over the place. And he's then got this money and he's put it in a sheet in the oven and then the copper asks for a light I'll do it
and then he has a go at them, doesn't he, for bothering him. He says because he's obviously false. Disgruntled because he's
that false bravado of like trying to sort of say he's been disturbed when he's trying to get rid of them sort of thing. It's very cleverly written, and as you say, there's bits in there that weren't in the original book, which I think added to the plot very well.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read the book, but apparently Garber is a minor character, and there's none of the intercom banter, because I think maybe the strength of this film is the intercom banter.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's probably the main selling point.
Even with the remake, it's a lot of. That's the main part of the film.
Yeah, it's a two-hander, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm
interested now to see how the book handles that.
Then. See, I bet the book is just a narrative about the heist itself, about the robbery. And there's no real character development as such like that.
Well, apart from you get the backstory and stuff, but like I said earlier...
It's interesting to hear what that is, yeah.
But like I said earlier, a clever film... I mean, we know quite a lot. We don't know loads, but we know basically what these four guys are, as you said.
Well, you get that very quickly. Yeah, you get that very quickly, is what I said. Can I just point out as well, Robert Shaw?
Sure.
Sure. King of the death scene.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Right. Well, you think...
That's seriously shocking.
Do they give the... Or was it... Is the death penalty in this state?
Yeah.
And he's like... No. It's a shame. Bang. That's the major thing. My first viewing of this film when I was like a teenager was the fact that he fucking stuck his foot on the electric rail.
And that's signposted as well, because when all the passengers are walking down the tunnel, they said,
watch the third rail.
Yeah.
But also, when you think about it, Robert Shaw in From Russia with Love, Jaws, and this movie knows how to do a death scene.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah.
That never hit me until last night.
And Battle of the Bulge as well.
That's on my watch list. Yeah.
That's genuinely shocking. I mean, for someone to do that to themselves to avoid prison.
Use the pun.
Use the pun, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Another great line when that Kaz Dolowitz, you know, the guy gets shot?
Yeah.
The one who goes, the guy goes, I wouldn't go down there if I were you. I know you wouldn't. There's so many good lines, like all the cynicism is brilliant. And yeah, as I said, Patron earlier, when he says that, I figured out what they're going to do. They're going to fly the plane to Cuba.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what? I did do a bit of research about this. This was kind of the golden age for plane hijackings. Yeah. And there, apparently there were 100 between Cuba and the USA from 1968 to 1972.
Wow.
100. They list them all on Wikipedia.
That's two a month.
I know, that's serious hijacking, isn't it?
It's a living, isn't it?
Good maps, isn't the other thing, just going back to this prize of arms.
Yes.
Basically, Paul, is this film where these three guys rob an army base. Right. And what they do in that film is they pretend that they've got away, but they're still on the base.
Okay.
But in Pelham, they do the opposite. They pretend they're still on the train, and they go
away.
That was interesting,
And there's also similar sort of characters, like the Tom Bell character.
Exactly.
And there is, like we say, almost a blueprint for heist movies.
Mm.
And Tarantino followed it with Reservoir Dogs and tweaked it, like, you know, we said earlier. And the Mark Kermo thing that you were talking about, you know, the guide to making a perfect heist movie.
Yeah.
Break it down, you know.
Yeah.
Because in Reservoir Dogs, Mr. Blunt's the loose cannon. I suppose the thinker would be, what's this called? Nice Guy Eddie or his dad.
Oh, yeah. But it's all there, you know, all the elements are there.
Does Tarantino acknowledge that he took the colour names? I mean, he supposed he'd have to, wouldn't he?
Not sure, yeah.
He has said it.
Yeah, because we reviewed that, didn't we? And I think we pointed that out.
Yeah. Any more?
I don't think we've got any more. I was just going to say about the hostages, like we said earlier. They're kind of archetypes, okay? That, you know, they're not deep characters, but at least you get to know them. And you do kind of care about them, I suppose.
Yeah. You know? I loved the black guy in the typical 70s setup with the leather and the hat on, and he's trying to be cool, and it's just like they, even though this was set in the 70s, almost like some politically correct person has go, right, but you've got to have someone that's black, someone that's Hispanic, you've got to have some old guy that's white, you've got to have some kids.
It's before its time, isn't it?
It's literally gone through the whole spectrum.
But then again, New York was this bloody melting pot that London possibly wasn't at that
point. Yeah.
But are they making a comment about racism, or are they reflecting it? Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Hard to know.
That's a conversation for another podcast.
I'm not going to touch on that. No.
But like I said, with the ending, it's very difficult to do endings a lot of the time. And they found the perfect ending, didn't they?
It worked.
Yeah.
It's got it in its...
How many films have I sat here and reviewed and said, great film, but the ending was poor, or you think the writers have just got to a point and go, oh, we'll just do this.
Yeah.
You're so disappointed sometimes by a film's ending when it's been a great film and great acting and great plot, and they've just gone, bang.
Doesn't let just you down, end it does like it? That. Really doesn't.
As this was almost perfect in the way that you didn't have to see him be arrested. You didn't have to imagine anything other than the fact of the sneeze, Kazuntai, and he reopened the door that he just shut and gave that little look.
The dill pickle face.
Yeah,
I was going to say, how do you describe that face?
Yeah. It's like, you're nicked, son.
You're nicked. Yeah.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Can I just say, Anthony, you said that you probably watched this 30, 40 times.
Probably more than that, to be honest. I was embarrassed to say.
No, but will you be watching it again very soon?
No, I don't think so, no. Need to. Yeah, I've got a memory for these kind of films. I just don't really need to.
So, Paul, I mean, two watches in 10 years.
I watched it the other night and I nearly didn't watch it again because I know it so well.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially when I got it up on the TV and it's only 90 minutes.
Mm.
And it's not like... If it had been 2 hours, 2.5 hours, I'd have thought, oh, God, really? I've got to sit through this. But 90 minutes is the perfect timing for
Absolutely.
A film.
Absolutely.
I think, because you've just, it's done everything it needed to.
Exactly.
Just started watching it, and from the start with Walter Matthau in it, and like taking the piss out of these Japanese. And it's just like, it was like something familiar.
Yeah,
and it was just it's just like, I'd rather watch something like that than a film that someone's recommended to me. Oh, this is gonna be great, and not know. It was something I knew, and it was just like, just a comfortable pair of slippers type thing.
Yeah,
I know we can compare this to, because you're a big Marvel fan, but you've been watching the recent Marvel movies and been really disappointed, sort of thing.
The recent Marvel series, shockingly rubbish.
And things that you thought you could rely on have let you down recently. Yeah. But it's nice to go back to something that you're like, do you know what? Could watch that every day of the week or something like that every day of the week.
I'm actually getting to that point in life where I don't want to watch new films.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. Yeah.
There's just, they're setting you up for disappointment.
Yeah. You haven't got as much time to be disappointed anymore.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
When I go and watch a series, even though someone might have recommended five different series to me, which I might like, I'm flicking through and I'm going back to series I've watched 3-4 years
ago.
Because I know that I'm going to like it.
Absolutely. Let's leave it at that, guys. That's been really great today. What we're going to do, we're still celebrating our 10th anniversary.
We're milking it, aren't we?
We've got another couple of months to go. By the time this goes out, we're going to hit the end of the year, so there's not many more opportunities. I haven't selected a movie that we've reviewed previously yet. I'm going to take you back to episode 2. We'll be back in a minute.
Sure.
And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
Okay. So that was the take in the Pelham 1, 2, 3. We are still celebrating our 10th anniversary. And as I hinted before the break, we are going back to episode 2. Can anybody remember what the three movies were in episode 2?
No.
No. I'll tell you what the other two were. It was The Sting.
Okay, we've done that recently, which was all right.
And Space Jam.
I'm glad we're not touching on that.
Which again is sort of gone down in Stinky Paul's history as like a big mistake. Charlie fully admits that, you know. This was my choice, this was my choice, because what we used to do in the early days, me and Charlie chose a movie and then we had an anniversary movie. And I think The Sting was the anniversary movie. This particular movie, now we're sticking to the 70s, we're sticking to the Raging Bull,
Easy
Rider sort of like period. You know it, do you?
No.
Oh, I thought you said I know it. Okay. 1974, directed by Sidney Lumet, starring Al Pacino.
Oh, I love it.
Heist movie, sort of like a bank robbery movie, really. Dog Day After.
Ah. Brilliant. I have not seen this, but I've wanted to watch it. So many people I know have said, oh, this is a really good movie, or referred to it.
Yep.
So it's interesting. I really
it's
want to
not your typical height. It doesn't have the archetypes of the typical height, but it's got John Cazale. So
John Cazale, who is the guy that we've spoken to about five movies, five best picture nominees. I haven't watched it for 10 years, and again, Anthony, it was one of those ones that I used to watch on video because I'd recorded it 100 times, you know, when it was on TV. Paul, just take this in the similar vein that you've watched Taking a Pelham 1, 2, 3. It's a 74 movie, same year. There we go. Yeah.
Is this New York again? It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is New York.
I'm sure it's New York. It's got Charles Durning as the
cast. Charles Durning, yes.
John Cazale. Who's the boyfriend? Chris Sarandon. Yeah.
What I remember about this film, I don't want to give it away. I'm not giving it away, but he kind of gets the crowd on his side, doesn't he? He becomes a bit of a celebrity.
They mention Attica in Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Oh, they do. We don't want to know.
Don't want to know Attica. Yeah.
There you go. Beatles reference. Thank you.
Paul's just.
And I'll get my guitar out.
You happy with that?
I'm happy with that. Yep.
Okay. No, you'll love it. It's great. It's great.
We'll get together and work out a date for recording that in the not too distant future. Before we go, Anthony, is your opportunity, mate, to let the world know where they can find you.
God, I've completely forgotten. What am I doing podcasts again? Glass Onion on John Lennon, Deep Dive into John Lennon. Not like those other ones where they just rank tracks and things like that. We go deep, baby. Film Gold, Scott's been on there loads of times. Very 70s heavy. Well, what would I say? Hitchcock, 50s to 70s heavy, I'd say. And then Life and Life Only is more psychology and alternative media. And thanks for having me on again.
You are more than welcome, my friend. Paul, this is your opportunity to let all those ex-girlfriends know where you are.
No,
he said. Let's call it a day. Cheers, guys. Thank you very much. See you soon.
Thank you. Cheers.
The management of this theater suggests that for the greater entertainment of your friends who have not yet seen the picture, you will not divulge to anyone the secret of the ending.
Master Arms, that infernal jamboree is worse than two cats on a fence.
You dudes get lost now, you hear?
Good night, ladies.
Good night, sir.
When you feel down, try positive thinking. That's what I told the man, said, don't wear a frown. Try positive thinking, laugh at your troubles instead. You've got to look on the bright side, on hope so much depends. With your confidence sinking, positive thinking helps you on the way, my friend. When things look black, try positive thinking, treat every season as spring. No glancing back, try positive thinking, trust what tomorrow may bring. This crazy world that we live in will keep on spinning round, but with good, strong, positive thinking, we'll get together and life won't let us down.
Shut up, you ugly bitch.
Oh, shut up. We enjoy it.